After 3 years of globetrotting, Sarah and I finally settled in 1973 to our first proper marital home in a town in North Lancashire. Terraced house, cotton mill still clanking away at the end of the road. Round the corner there was a linoleum factory. Do you remember linoleum? Yes, some of us do. And so it was a proper northern Lancashire working class area. And the church, the parish church, was a great big sort of Victorian hulk built by the ecclesiastical commissioners in Victorian times for the good of the working classes. It was sort of that kind of place. And we started attending the parish church. And it had a congregation regularly on a Sunday of around 150 people. So it was quite a flourishing concern. But everybody knew that the size of the congregation was gradually diminishing. That was a kind of accepted fact. And being me, I was curious to know why. And so I talked to people. And it essentially was about the life cycle of the average churchgoer. Most people had started going to church as children, connected with the uniform groups or with the Sunday school or whatever. Then they would be confirmed at the age of 12 or so. And that was a kind of passing out parade. After being confirmed, a year or two later, they would sever all connections with the church as they went off to be teenagers for a bit. But then sometime later, in early middle age perhaps, when they had children of their own, they would return to church and start attending again. And so the life cycle would continue. The trouble was there was a leakage. Not everybody who went to Sunday school then joined again in middle age. Some simply drifted away entirely, hence the slight shrinkage. And the church didn't attract anybody from outside that circle of people who had been to church as children. There were no genuinely new converts that had no connection with Christianity but started coming to church. So in a sense, the church was operating on a kind of momentum from the past. And that momentum was gradually diminishing, as momentum does, if you don't give it an extra push. Hence the shrinkage. And I soon found, I was new to the church in those days, that mainstream churches of all kinds, Methodist, Anglican, whatever, were in the same position, gently declining and not bringing in people from outside the circle. It was a common pattern. And then, in the early 90s, or late 1990s, something rather unexpected happened. The number of people returning to church in middle age didn't just go like that, it suddenly went like that. And the consequence, and this hasn't been fully appreciated, the consequence was that in our churches today, ordinary mainstream churches I'm talking about, there are very, very few people, not nobody, but very few, born after about 1965. Most of us here are born before 1965. Some people, a long time before 1965, I told you to say that, I'm in that category, but there's very few people born after. And I go and preach in various churches around the country, and the pattern is the same. Most of the congregation is pre-1960, actually, very few after. It's something that, as one church statistician has put it, we appear to be one generation from extinction. When us baby boomers pop our clogs, what will be left? It does look rather dismal at the moment. Now, in this bleak picture, something happened that seemed, and I think still does, but seemed to offer a way out of this dilemma, seemed to be able to break out of the church and bring in new people. And that was the charismatic movement. It started in the mid-60s, but really its zenith was from the mid-70s to the mid-80s. I think that would be roughly right. And for those of you not familiar with the charismatic movement, essentially what it was about was people receiving what they called baptism of the Spirit. In other words, roughly what happened at the first Pentecost. They would receive the Holy Spirit. And then all sorts of gifts would become manifest, like healing, prophecy, and so on, but particularly speaking in tongues. And typically the tongues were unintelligible, but then somebody else would interpret what was being said. That was what the charismatic movement, in essence, was all about. And it swept the world. It was just quite extraordinary. Churches throughout the world were being renewed by the charismatic renewal movement. So whole churches would suddenly be transformed. I mean, I saw this in Lancashire. There was a very dismal Anglican church in the middle of a town. And within 2 or 3 years, it was bursting at the seams. It had experienced charismatic renewal. And it was across the denominations, Roman Catholic, Anglican, various free churches and so on, all were caught up in this astonishing movement. And it did bring in people from outside, as it were. It appealed to people who had no Christian background at all, who would start joining charismatic prayer groups or joining these churches that had experienced renewal. It was breaking out of the sort of circle of a church and bringing in people from outside. It offered hope. It was very, very exciting. And then, sometime around the mid-90s, it fizzled out. Almost as soon as it began, it disappeared. Nobody much seemed to remark on it. It seemed to me an astonishing thing that it had disappeared, but it did. In fact, one of the leading Anglican charismatics, a man called Michael Harper, of whom you may have heard, he went off to be an Orthodox priest under the Patriarch of Antioch. So the Church of England altogether got a most wonderful hat, actually. And that's what you get if you're a priest in the Eastern churches. Good hat. But so, in other words, it dissipated in all sorts of different ways, and that's what happened. I vaguely knew Michael Harper, he's dead now. So the thing, as I say, seemed to fizzle out. And it's easy to conclude, as I think a lot of people have, that actually it was just a kind of historical phenomenon. They just sort of popped up and then popped down again, and it has no great significance. And they might compare it, and I've seen this comparison, with the Welsh revival in the early 20th century. It suddenly burst on the scene and then disappeared. And the charismatic movement has been compared with that. Now, it does have a legacy, a visible legacy. The hymns is one thing. A remarkable number of hymns in the other hymnal that we use are products of the charismatic movement. And Graham Kendrick did indeed write some good hymns, I have to admit it, and some very good hymns. So that's one legacy. Another legacy is some of the churches that experience renewal are still very vibrant. And I know of one near where I preach regularly in Luton, St. Hughes, where Colin Urquhart was. That remains a very vibrant church. But many churches that experience renewal have actually disappeared. And I think that's true to say at the community church here in Stamford. I mean, it was a product of the charismatic movement, and now I think hardly exists. Is that right? Yeah. I mean, so many churches that experience renewal, some have remained vibrant, but many haven't. Many have just sort of dissipated. So are we supposed just to put that into history? You see, we had this sign of hope, this seeming possibility of bringing in new people, and we've lost it, and that's that. We just ignore it. I don't think that's right. I think the charismatic movement remains, and it might surprise you to hear me say this, hugely significant, with wonderful lessons for the future. In fact, two lessons in particular, and two warnings. Now, lesson number one, the most important lesson, is in a word that you might find problematic, and I'll come back to the problems of the word in a bit. The word is mysticism. It was a mystical movement. Now, by mysticism, I mean a direct encounter with God, of actually meeting God in himself. Too often, Christianity seems like chunks of theology, beliefs that you have to somehow get your head round about God. What evangelicalism and what the charismatic movement was about was not about knowing about God, it was knowing God directly. That's the whole, what it was all about. And that's what made it so exciting. So in that sense, if that's what you mean by mysticism, it was a mystical movement. That was its attraction. You actually got to know God directly. And that's why people were drawn in. And you were sort of, as it were, taken up by the Spirit into a direct relationship with Jesus Christ and with the Father. That was the excitement. But the corresponding warning was hubris. As the charismatic movement became more confident, it kind of gave the impression that if you prayed hard enough, and you would receive baptism of the Spirit. In other words, they were putting God to the test. We do this and you'll do that. And that's not how it works. God's grace comes because he chooses, not because we demand. And yet there seemed to be that demand. And I remember going to speak at charismatic movements in Yorkshire at that time. And there were people really troubled by the fact that they had prayed really hard and hadn't experienced baptism of the Spirit. They hadn't started speaking in tongues. In fact, I found myself ministering on one occasion to a nun in full habit who had been desperately praying for baptism of the Spirit, hadn't received it, and experienced that as God rejecting her. She felt God had just pushed her aside, which was a terrible thing. She had devoted her life to God, and yet she felt pushed aside. And some people, sadly, many people, concluded the whole thing was a con, and that it should be just tossed aside. So the hubris proved profoundly damaging. It wasn't about trusting God to do things, it was about us demanding it. And that will always lead to misery. You have to trust in God. So that's a lesson, and that's a warning. The second lesson is very, very mundane, summed up in the word courses. What do I mean by that? What I mean is this. When I used to go and speak at charismatic meetings at these days, how they started was essentially what the meetings were prayer groups from all over the place in that part of Yorkshire meeting to sort of compare notes, as it were, see how we're getting on, and then have more fellowship and what have you later on. And so at the beginning of the day, the prayer groups would come and report in. And one of my jobs was to be sort of chairman of those sort of meetings. Some of the prayer groups were following courses, and there were two or three really good courses that the charismatic movement produced, and some were freewheeling and doing what sort of struck them. And that seemed to be, they assumed they were being guided by the Spirit, and using a course was somehow not quite the thing. They were wrong. The groups that had good courses, biblically based, always had a much better experience than those that were freewheeling. We need to learn. We need to be humble enough to learn from others. And those who were freewheeling, there was a kind of pride, again, hubris in a way, that was causing that. And those that were following a course, as I say, almost always did much better in their prayer groups. But there was a problem. Typically, the courses were 6 or 7 weeks. And you get to the end of the course, and time after time, groups reporting in said, what next? We finished the course. Some of us are speaking in tongues, not all of us, but some of us. What do we do now? And there wasn't a clear answer to that question, the what next question. Nobody knew. And so what happened, typically, is the prayer groups, having finished the course, would meet and have a time of spontaneous prayer, fellowship and whatnot, and then go home. And that would work fine for a few months. But after a bit, it sort of lost its way. People were not kind of knowing quite what to do. And many of the prayer groups simply dissipated. I mean, I was a member of two prayer groups, one here in Stamford, one somewhere else. And I'm sad to say both of them lost their way. Not in a bad way. They didn't sort of, immorality didn't break out or anything like that. It was simply they didn't know what they were supposed to be doing and eventually dispersed. So answering the what next question is absolutely vital. Now, you may think things like the charismatic movement, as I was saying earlier, are simply temporary phenomena. They'll only last for a few years and then fizzle out. You may think that's sort of the nature of the beast, but it's not. Historically, there are charismatic movements that have lasted for decades and centuries. And I mentioned just two. One is the Franciscans. Back in the early 13th century, even longer ago than any of us can remember, the St. Francis attracted thousands upon thousands upon thousands upon thousands of young men, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of young men dedicated to evangelism. It was quite extraordinary. It was just swept through Europe. And these Franciscan friars in their brown woolen habits would preach. They would turn up at a village and simply say, we're preaching, and off they'd go. And they were spreading the word. It was very, and the word they were spreading was about a direct relationship with God. That's what Francis's teaching was, and that's what the evangelists were saying. It's not about God, it's God, the direct relationship. It was mystical in that sense. So that's one. And that carried on, the impetus of the Franciscan movement carried on for two or three centuries in Europe, and you can still find it elsewhere. So it has proved a very enduring movement, and it was essentially a charismatic movement. The other one that many of you will be very familiar with is Methodism. Now, John and Charles Wesley were mystics. They had this wonderful relationship with God. Read Charles Wesley's hymns, and we're about to sing one. For example, the one we're going to sing, O Thou Who Camest From Above. That is a stunning hymn. Only a person with a vibrant, living relationship with God could write a hymn like that. Charles Wesley lived with God, and that's how these explosion of hymns from his pen came about. And note that in that hymn, O Thou Who Camest From Above, he's addressing God directly. O Thou, he's talking to God directly. That is the product of charismatic renewal. Talk to God directly. And that's a hymn, talking to God. And John Wesley was deeply influenced by a man called William Law, who lived not far from here in Kingscliff down the road. And he was wrote the most wonderful mystical books. The Serious Call to the Devout Life is the most famous. And he became a friend of John Wesley and had a huge influence on him. And he likewise was stressing the essence of Christianity is the direct relationship with God. So that was a huge influence. And Law, in turn, was influenced by mystical movements in Lutheran Germany. So it was quite a sort of widespread thing. And if you think of those wonderful words in John Wesley's journal about his conversion, I'm not sure that's quite the right word, actually, because he was already a devout Christian. But anyway, about my heart being strangely warmed, I mean, those are the words of a real mystic, of somebody who knows God directly, and God is coming into him. So the Methodist movement was a charismatic movement, and they answered the question, what next? They formed Methodist societies, and the Methodist societies were divided into classes, and there would be class meetings with a class leader who would guide people, and everybody would share, but they would guide people in the way of prayer week by week. So there was an answer to the what next, and often the type of prayer they had and the format of prayer was actually quite formal, hence the word Methodist. It was methodical. They thought prayer has to be methodical in order for the Spirit to sort of, as it were, break in. There's an odd paradox here. You have to be quite methodical in order to be set free. But that was a paradox that the Wesleys understood. And that was why Methodism was so successful. Spread across Britain, to America, all over the world, bringing millions to a living faith in Jesus Christ. It was a charismatic movement. And it has lasted. Well, I think in this country, if you go into a Methodist church now, I don't want to be rude about this, but you don't feel the same sort of sense of vibrancy always. Maybe some you do. So maybe it's slightly run out of steam in this country, but it's still flourishing elsewhere. And it lasted in this country as a real movement for at least two centuries. So charismatic movements can be long-term, and that's what we must pray for. Now, let me come back briefly to that word mysticism. I know a lot of people find it problematic, and so did Wesley. At first, John Wesley was actually used it about himself. He would say, I'm a mystic, I have a relationship with God. But he came to fear that mysticism tended to encourage a kind of spiritual self-indulgence, where you were just concerned with your own experiences and not concerned with the needs of the world. So eventually, John Wesley abandoned the word mysticism and actually wrote quite critically of it. I'm happy about that. It's another problem with the word is it's not biblical. You can't find the word mystic in the Bible. But we've sung a hymn and we've heard a reading which has the most wonderful promise of charismatic renewal. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Let's go that once more. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. That is the promise, that we will see God. And although we may not see him face to face, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 13, we still see him through a glass darkly. We still see God. That's the promise of being a Christian. You see God. And that's, mystic is one word for that, but let's use it. You shall see God. What we're talking about is the you shall see God movement. And I believe it will happen again. I think the charismatic movement was a foretaste. And there will be a you shall see God movement at some time up to God. And our business is to pray for it and hope for it and prepare for it.